People were supposed to learn history to avoid repeating it. Instead, they used it to keep fueling their grudges. Good greetings to you folks. How you doing? This is Keith Tyler, your volunteer broadcaster, bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and Arizona's own Twist Phelan brings us our first story, and it's called Dupe. Her expense report finished, Finn Teller shut her laptop with a satisfying snap. She stood and walked to the narrow window, which offered a view of gondolas bobbing in a canal. She frowned. Gondolas? Canal? Finn had flown in late last night, exhausted, the bandage around her arm seeping blood, both compliments of her latest mission. She'd slept most of the time in the air before stumbling through customs and immigration at the private jet terminal. McAuliffe told her to meet him in Portugal, and she could have sworn the driver who dropped her at the company apartment after the hour-long drive had said, "Bem-vindo a Portugal." Welcome to Portugal. So how had she ended up 1,400 miles away in Venice? Tightening her squint, she saw the painted building facades that lined the waterway were devoid of Italianate flourishes, and she recognized Aveiro, the city built on the lagoon south of Porto on Portugal's west coast. She was looking not at gondolas, but barcos molicarios, bright-colored boats traditionally built to harvest seaweed, but now used to ferry tourists. Finn yawned and stretched until a stab of pain reminded her of the wound on her arm. She examined the grubby field dressing. She'd get it rebandaged by her employer's local medical staff, then head back to the apartment to sleep. There were 72 hours before she was due in Cyprus, and she planned to spend 70 of them in bed. Finn worked as a private spy for SIA, Strategic Information Associates. By design, the company's name was not very forthcoming. For some decision-makers who ran multinational corporations and leaders of political regimes, no further explanation was necessary. The company's operatives did a lot of the same work for individuals, companies, and governments that the CIA did for the U.S. government. The knock on the door was perfunctory. By the time Finn turned away from the window, John McAuliffe was already in the room. "I heard the TSA job went well," he said. "Good job breaking up the theft ring."
"Yeah, not my favorite undercover," Finn said.
8 hours a day looking for things that go boom bang or that burn. You have almost no real power, zilch, cultural cachet, and are a favorite target of the can-I-speak-to-your-manager crowd. No wonder 20% of screeners quit within 6 months. McAuliffe indicated her arm.
"Oh, what happened?"
"Cut it on some plastic. More accurately, a 3D-printed knife blade that passenger tried to smuggle through security. But Finn didn't see the need to tell McAuliffe that. It looks worse than it is."
"Okay, glad to hear it.
Tomorrow, we'll talk about Cyprus. Right now, I want you to come with me to..." McAuliffe glanced at his watch.
Brunch.
"I didn't know you had that word in your vocabulary," Finn said. "Thanks, but pass. Brunch isn't really my thing, and if I wanted to waste a morning eating, I'd stay in bed with a box of Triscuits."
It wasn't a question.
"I should have the doc check my arm. You just said it looks worse than it is, but I'm happy to wait."
Finn blew out a breath.
"I probably won't die in the next hour."
She picked up her jacket from the back of her chair. And I am hungry, but I draw the line at IHOP.
McAuliffe started for the door.
Don't worry. I've got a place.
Finn followed.
You have a brunch place? What's next, telling me you're working with a personal stylist?
They emerged onto the sidewalk. It was hot, but at least not the hammer blows that stun tourists in July and August. McAuliffe walked swiftly, Finn at his side. Though neither spoke, Finn felt a frisson of, she wasn't sure what, from her boss. It was flickering like a shadow before it was gone. It made her uneasy.
15 minutes later, McAuliffe turned into an alley. He led Finn past a dumpster redolent of Chinese food and stopped in front of a green wooden door set into a cinder block wall. Beside it was stacked a pyramid of silvery beer kegs.
McAuliffe rapped on the door, its weathered look the result of age rather than expert painting.
"This is your place?" Finn said.
"Books, covers," McAuliffe said as the door was opened by a ruddy-faced man, 50-ish, with red hair losing ground to gray. He wore a thin black tie, black trousers, and a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up past the elbows.
"Ah, jays." The two syllables conveying as much Irishness as a fifth of Jameson.
"You nearly put the heart across me, McAuliffe. It's been donkey years."
"You're looking well, Sean," McAuliffe said.
"Tanks,"
Sean said, pronouncing it tanks.
"You know, that thing you told me about that fella the last time you was here. You was bang on. He was right sleeving.
I'm glad to be useful."
The man raised his chin.
So what you be needin'?"
"We're here for brunch," McAuliffe said.
"Brunch?"
Sean repeated, the word as though he'd never heard it before.
"My thought exactly," Finn said.
McAuliffe ignored her. "We'd like something to eat and drink."
"Well, then you better come in," Sean said, and led them inside.
Hunter green walls, polished wooden bar, gleaming beer taps, the place was a match for every Irish pub Finn had ever stepped into around the world. The interior was dark even at midday. The sconces turned so low, Sean's white shirt seemed to wend through the tables like a spirit. Despite the government's indoor smoking ban, the smell of cigarettes hung in the air. Finn sniffed appreciatively. She'd quit, but she still missed her smokes. The room was empty of people. Sean showed them to a table in the corner.
"And now what can I get you, a touch of the black stuff?"
"It's a bit early for Guinness," McAuliffe said. Finn frowned.
"Meh, speak for yourself."
She addressed Sean. "I'd like a cheese and mushroom omelet and a mimosa, please. Is your juice fresh squeezed?" Sean glanced at McAuliffe.
"Is she having me on?"
"She is. How about two teas and toast?"
"Won't be a minute."
Sean left. "Tea and toast isn't brunch, it's prisoner's rations," Finn grumbled. She glanced around the interior.
"Isn't this a bit of a, stereotype, even for someone with the last name McAuliffe? His place looks like it had a jar on the back bar in the day."
"It did," McAuliffe said. Finn knew not an insignificant amount of funding for the Irish Republican Army during the Troubles. The Northern Ireland national conflict had lasted from the late 1960s to 1998. Had been from non-residents who identified with the nationality of their Irish ancestors. The money often came via cash or checks made out to Sinn Féin and stuffed into jars kept for the purpose at overseas Irish pubs, a practice resented on both sides by those who hoped for peace. They shouldn't be funding a war that isn't theirs, was a common sentiment. Ireland was such an old country, Finn thought. So much past, so many mistakes. People were supposed to learn history and avoid repeating it. Instead,
They used it to keep fueling their grudges. Sean delivered their meal, a basket of warm brown bread with sides of dairy butter and chunky marmalade, and a pot of tea that, when poured, was dark enough to pass for coffee. As Finn spread butter on a thick, crumbly slice, she had to admit any prisoners who were served it would be living large.
Is there a reason we're here other than this bread? She asked after chewing a generous mouthful.
WikiLeaks, McAuliffe wasn't eating, only sipping his tea. Since it launched in 2006, the website had become renowned for publishing thousands of classified documents covering everything from the film industry and national security and wars.
Another document dump? Finn asked.
McAuliffe nodded. I got a call from the agency this morning. Some of the documents related to field operations, not official files, but secondary evidence, diary entries, receipts, CCTV footage.
Do they want us to ID the leaker?
Finn asked. She abandoned her toast and was playing with the salt and pepper shakers, moving them around on the checkered tablecloth as though they were chess pieces. She and McAuliffe had met while both worked for the agency, a.k.a. the Central Intelligence Agency. Finn joined out of college, and McAuliffe was one of her instructors at the farm, the agency's training facility at Camp Perry, and later her supervisor in the field. Events forced Finn to walk away from her job. McAuliffe left too and started SIA. Finn had been one of his first hires. From time to time, the agency employed SIA for jobs it didn't want to or legally couldn't do. Now, they have questions about an operation. The documents disclosed by WikiLeaks seem to contradict a report that was filed by the operative. Finn moved the pepper-turned knight two spaces vertically and one space horizontally to take the cream pitcher.
Are the Wiki docs real?
Well, apparently so.
What do they want us to do?
They sent me the report that was filed and a copy of what was posted online and asked me to look into the gaps between the two. They're looking for clarification, illumination even. They want to make sure they know the full story.
The sense of foreboding that had struck Finn earlier returned stronger than before.
What station?
Belfast.
At his mention of the Northern Ireland city, Finn's hands stilled.
Well, why am I here? She asked.
McAuliffe leaned in, his over-casualness almost coy.
Well, you were assigned there, weren't you?
Finn nearly laughed. McAuliffe knew she had been. He probably had the dates memorized. Like a good trial lawyer, her boss rarely asked a question he didn't know the answer to. She thought of terrace houses, topped with century-like chimneys, barred and wired checkpoints, sprawling graffiti murals on concrete walls, depicting heroes and martyrs from both sides. The children. Finn had never seen so many, and there was one child in particular.
Well, for a hot minute, she answered.
Remember much about it? Finn felt the dread of burying the past at the very same instant she felt the desire to erase it. Better yet, to have never known it at all. Belfast had been one of her early postings, one that nearly brought her career to a crashing halt before it even got started, and probably would have if McAuliffe hadn't stepped in and asked her to join his newly formed field unit. She picked up the pepper shaker again.
Well, I remember the Titanic Museum. What a massive amount of steel and concrete to devote to commemorating a colossal failure. Beyond that, not much. There have been a lot of cities since. I can barely keep them straight. Just this morning, I thought I was in Venice.
I went through what the agency sent while you were on the TSA job.
I think I know what happened, at least up to the end. I wanted to run it by you and get your take.
Is this why we're brunching in an Irish pub? atmosphere?
McAuliffe pinned her with his gaze. I thought it might jog your memory.
Finn affected a shrug. Yeah, it can't hurt, she said, while thinking of several reasons it could,
none of them which she wanted to share with him.
The 1998 Good Friday Agreement may have stopped the bombs, but it didn't resolve the conflict, McAuliffe said.
Finn listened impatiently as he described the two sides. The Catholics, who predominantly considered themselves Irish, still held nationalist views. They wanted a unified, independent Ireland free from British control. The Protestants, who identified largely as British and Unionist, wanted to remain linked to the United Kingdom.
So both switched from guerrilla to political warfare, he finished.
I know. The Belfast briefing book covered all this. So did the news.
McAuliffe poured more tea. His toast remained untouched.
In case you're interested, unification is more popular now than ever, thanks to Brexit being less of a success than anticipated, and one-time IRA darling Sinn Féin becoming the majority party. Plus, Catholics finally outnumber Protestants in the North.
Finn faked a yawn.
Yeah, thanks, Teach.
10 years after the GFA, the struggle was still alive, McAuliffe said, unperturbed. He went on about how each side was still trying to get the advantage over the other, that while ordinary citizens of the North and South rejoiced in the demise of the violence, Irish and British spies continued to extract secrets from the innocent and the guilty.
Finn was only half listening, her brain focused on the why behind McAuliffe's mini-lecture on history they both were well acquainted with. Her boss was ordinarily unadorned and, to the point in most things, his manner of speaking, his way of moving, even his style of dress. This felt like a preface, a build-up to something else.
The Americans wanted to know which way the wind was blowing and whose feathers were being ruffled by it. Also had some agents in the mix, McAuliffe said. Some were experienced, some were young, because many of the kids who'd grown up behind peace walls, Finn made a dismissive noise. At peace walls? What a brilliant marketing term for something not all that different from the Berlin version. The barriers may have kept Catholics and Protestants apart, especially in poor neighborhoods, but they didn't do much for peace. Most of the violence happened near wherever they were. And in a win for irony, there are twice as many of them now than before the agreement was signed.
So you've kept up with the Irish situation. Interesting, McAuliffe said.
I know that those kids who walked extra miles to school because of peace walls, who watched older relatives get sucked into the violence and be arrested, injured, or killed, they became politically active once they grew up.
McAuliffe spread his hands.
No big surprise. Groups opposing unification wanted to stir up trouble. Groups in favor wanted to neutralize them. Many people still hated the Provos and the Ulster forces and wanted to punish those who'd helped them.
Finn grimaced at the mention of Provos and the Ulster forces. The Provisional Irish Republican Army and the Ulster Voluntary Force were the extremist paramilitary factions of the conflict. In any event, the agency needed ops to monitor the situation, even though the states technically didn't have a dog in the fight, McAuliffe continued. As the words, "the agency needed ops," Finn knew what story McAuliffe had been building to. It was one she didn't want to hear, and she was beginning to suspect the reason he was telling it. The ops were there to gather info, not to influence or provoke, and they had to be the participants' age. One of them was a young woman. Let's call her Don't, Finn blurted.
Fiona, McAuliffe said, as though she hadn't spoken.
Only one person called Finn by her given name. Her father. He was more out of her life than in, and she hadn't been called Fiona in a long time. Okay, she said, although it wasn't. Fiona it is.
Fiona, as you might imagine, was thrilled with her assignment, McAuliffe said. Her first overseas posting less than 6 months after finishing her training at the farm. Quite an honor, but not surprising. Her instructors had tapped her as a real talent, a rising star.
Finn cocked her head. Well, I wonder which instructors did the tapping.
Fiona was given a list of several names, McAuliffe said. Her job was to insinuate herself into their lives, become an acquaintance, better yet, a friend.
Bonus points if she got as far as lover.
McAuliffe gave her a look.
Finn held up her hands in surrender. I know. Against official agency policy, too bad the real world doesn't follow it.
Neither did agency black ops, she knew from experience.
Fiona did well connecting with her assigned charges, McAuliffe said. She worked out at their gym in the winter and swam in the sea in the summer.
The conversation became a series of snapshots to Finn, like flashes in a dream. A converted boxing gym was the in place to work out. Finn remembered what it smelled like more than what it looked like. No matter how much lemon-scented disinfectant was laid down by the owners, a lingering odor of moldy, heavy sweat bags, unwashed canvas, and sweaty ring ropes remained. She'd been relieved when the group moved on to CrossFit Box downtown. Even in August, ocean swimming was nearly intolerable. Cold would burn her skin before turning it numb. Her heart beat hard enough to bruise ribs. The much-heralded calm never descending. Her first time, Finn had lasted 5 minutes, perhaps eight, before bursting from the water to where she dropped her dry robe on the pebbled beach. Ate at their favorite cafes. The memories were coming faster now. Unless it was pouring, they'd always choose a table outside so most of them could smoke. An unexpected touch of Santa Fe. Sweet chili jam made with habaneros had been Finn's choice for Sunday morning scones. Went on shopping trips to boutiques. Finn fingered the sterling silver bangle on her wrist. She'd purchased it from a shop in the Warren of Victorian and Edwardian buildings near the city center, and drank at their local pub. Housed in a brick building dating back to the 1860s, with a security cage around the front door, left as a reminder of the more recent past, the low-arched, cozy space had become the living room Finn's studio apartment lacked. The pub was known for its quiz nights, McAuliffe said. Fiona knew friends had put together a team and asked her to join. McAuliffe passed a hand over his face. He looked tired, Finn thought, and old.
Fiona was supposed to be rotated out of Belfast after 18 months, he said. She was a young agent. You know, you can only live so long pretending to work at a job by day, always saying yes when someone suggested a trip to the gym or the cafe or the boutique or the pub. Burnout happens even under the best of circumstances.
So why'd they leave her in for so long? Finn said, remembering the feeling of unsaid words vibrating against the back of her teeth when the question came for the umpteenth time.
No, I'm not in marketing. I work for the CIA. Yeah, that CIA.
Logistics. It was decided it would be hard to hand over her network to someone new. She'd insinuated herself so well within the group that if some didn't like her replacement, well, what if none of them did?
So what happened? Finn asked, even though she knew.
She was mired in a sludge of memories, with McAuliffe pulling her in deeper.
Fiona fell in love.
Unbidden, a low sound rose in Fiona's throat. She busied herself pouring more tea. It had gone cold.
Go on, she muttered into her cup.
McAuliffe ticked off what had happened as though he were giving a PowerPoint presentation. It started in the pub the week before Christmas, open fire blazing quiz night, Fiona's team won, not unusual. Their prize? DNA testing kits. Definitely unusual. Finn remembered the pub owner saying he'd gotten the kits free from some upstart company doing genealogy testing, prompting many in bad taste jokes about Irish inbreeding and romantic liaisons with unknown cousins. Finn hadn't ever worried about the former. A half-Irish and half-English father and a half-Croatian, half-Roma mother made her pure mongrel. Four nationalities that she knew of to choose from, which still didn't know which one she would claim. Which was the best fit? Which label felt right? McAuliffe broke into her thoughts. Fiona said she was going to toss hers. Wait, Finn said. How can you possibly know that? It's not something that would be in a report. Finn included only facts in her write-ups. No feelings, no possibilities, no suppositions, no paths not taken. Diary entries on WikiLeaks. I don't think the agency knew they existed, assuming they're accurate. They are, Finn thought unhappily. She'd lit the fire in the grate herself. But apparently at least one of the other participants had memorialized the evening, too. The agency thinks the stuff online came from accidental discoveries, hard drives that thought were destroyed, documents forgotten in storage units, journals stashed in grandmother's attic. McAuliffe tore a toast piece into strips, then lined up the ragged soldiers on his plate. Well, anyway, Fiona planned to throw away her test. Maybe she was smart enough to know it wasn't a good idea for an ops DNA to be in external databases. But the quiz team leader said he dared everyone to spit into the tubes and see how many extra cousins they had. And he'd stand them 2 rounds of beer, if they were all brave enough. Of course, everyone took him up on it. Fiona couldn't opt out without drawing too much attention, so she went along. The team leader collected them all and put them in mail the next day. A diary entry told you that? No, social media. Some team members posted their results several weeks later. McAuliffe tapped his lips with his forefinger. Here's where things go off the rails. Finn focused on keeping her expression neutral, registered only the main bits as he spoke. But then, she didn't have to listen carefully. Even though she hadn't thought about the story for almost 10 years, she knew it. Oh, how she knew it. Several weeks into the new year, the quiz team leader had invited Fiona over to his flat. Something he'd never done before. She was prepared for a romantic overture at best, to fend off rape at worst. She wasn't prepared for what he did deliver. The results of her DNA test. Results, McAuliffe said, that showed she had a son, and wondered of wonders, he was in Ireland, in Belfast. Finn crimped her mouth shut, determined not to speak. No comment, McAuliffe said. She waved a casual hand. It's your party, your brunch, I mean. I'm just here to listen. McAuliffe continued. Turns out Fiona had donated, more like sold. She was paid $10,000, her eggs, while she was in college. While the recipients beat the 60% failure rate, the baby conceived from her donation developed a blood disorder as a toddler and needed a transfusion. His parents, what's the right word for them, non-bio, registered the child with all the DNA sites as part of their search for a donor. They found one on the father's side of the family, an uncle who lived in Belfast. And the kid recovered. But they forgot to delete their info from one of the genealogy sites, the one where Fiona's saliva sample was sent.
Finn glanced over at the bar, where Sam polished beer glasses and sent him an extrasensory message to check on them. She could use some of the brown stuff, Jameson, whatever the Irish used to drown their anxiety. Sean kept polishing. "Can I take a bathroom break?" Finn said. "Of course," McAuliffe said. "I'll get Sean to bring us Guinness," Finn thought. "Guinness, Guinness, Guinness. More tea." There went the last of her belief in telepathy. Finn pushed back her chair. The look McAuliffe gave her as she got up would have made a younger Finn, one fresh off the farm and newly assigned to Belfast, flinch. That she knew he was capable of worse was small consolation. She walked along the hallway where they'd entered. Instead of turning into the alcove with two doors labeled Jack's and Jill's, she kept going out into the alley. There she took several gulps of air that, if possible, smelled even more of pork, fried rice, and egg rolls. She was half tempted to keep walking, hail a taxi to the apartment, to the airport, or anywhere, an Irish goodbye, leave without making her farewells. But she knew it wouldn't solve anything. McAuliffe clearly knew the story up to the ending, and he had an idea on that, she could tell. He wouldn't back off until he found out if her version matched his. She sucked in one rancid breath and then went back inside. Waiting on the table were a bowl of potato chips and two Guinness draughts, their small heads marking Sean as the master of the two-part pour. Finn reconsidered her psychic powers. She sat and took a grateful sip as McAuliffe watched her, his drink untouched. "What did you do?" Finn said after 30 seconds ticked by. McAuliffe always could get her to blink first. Reached out to the boy's parents. Perhaps they were open-hearted people. Perhaps they felt they owed the universe acts of generosity for saving Eamon. That's what the boy's name was. But they welcomed Fiona into their lives. Finn said, taking another swallow of her beer. It was warmer than the tea. Visits with the family in the park became dinners in their home. Fiona was a guest at Eamon's fourth birthday. It got to where his parents trusted her to pick him up from preschool, babysit the occasional evening, buying him toys, reading to him during visits, taking him to the zoo. She couldn't do enough for the little boy. She was obsessed. It was as though she'd found a part of her she didn't know was missing, and she was going to hold on to it for dear life. McAuliffe finally took a drink of his beer, then looked over the top of the glass at her. Finding your biological child, can you imagine what that would feel like? The shake of Fiona's head was stiff. Nope. She thought about what it was like to work for the agency, especially overseas. The line that people at work were like family was just BS. Her job and that of those around her was all about lying. You lied to assets to convert them to your side. You lied to supervisors about crossing the line and operations in the field. You lied to innocents to get them to do what you wanted them to do in furtherance of an operation. You lied to anyone who might get close to you about what you actually did for your job and who you did it to and for. This applied to lovers, friends, even your family, assuming you kept in touch with the latter after too many missed Christmases and weddings. That meant the only people you could be truthful with were work colleagues, people who were just as comfortable with lying as you were, people for whom dishonesty had become second nature, like breathing. As a result, everyone ended up lonely. Finn was tempted to ask McAuliffe how someone Fiona's age, at that point in her career, was supposed to understand the allure of the sudden emergence of an unknown child, how she could have prepared herself for how that child delighted, inspired, broke her out of her gloom that all the lies and subterfuge had cloaked her in. Finn wanted to know if he understood how she'd do anything, even betray the code she built her professional life on, to keep that connection.
Finn shifted in her seat. Afraid I'm losing the point here.
The point is, Fiona cut back on the time she spent with her new friends. So lost was she in the little boy, they noticed that eventually so did her agency supervisor. Her friends' invitations dried up along with her intel. No doubt the agency wasn't enlightened back in those days. You know, work-life balance, quiet quitting, single-parent leave, you know, all that. I'm sure it still isn't, and you can't accommodate an employee who's a parent, or whatever you want to call it in this situation, if you're in the dark. Fiona didn't tell the agency about Eamon. His word skittered around Finn's mind, along with the language from the briefing book. All non-casual civilian encounters are to be logged. All repeated encounters are to be logged and reported to the operative supervisor for evaluation and follow-up. She knew the boy would be considered a chink in her armor, or a liability to maintaining her cover. McAuliffe paused. She was right on both points. Both? Finn heard the rasp in her voice and swigged some beer. The agency would have posted her to another country or sent her back to the States if they had known about Eamon. And as it turned out, he did become a liability.
Well, if you say so.
WikiLeaks says so. The overture came about 2 months after Fiona had connected with Eamon and his family, sent by way of one of the quiz team people, a fellow who showed up now and then. Someone on the periphery of their group. He pulled Fiona aside one evening in the pub, told her he knew who she really worked for and what her job really was, and that he knew all about Eamon.
Finn remembered the plasticky feel of the tracky jacket, the eye-watering whiff of aftershave as the man pushed up against her at the bar. Colin, that was his name.
What did he want? She croaked. She gulped more Guinness and nearly choked.
What the Brits always wanted, McAuliffe said after her cough subsided.
Names. People who'd been in the IRA, helped the IRA, funded the IRA, even said the initials, IRA. Everything the agency had. If she didn't come through, Eamon would be disappeared.
Finn suppressed a shiver. Ireland was one of the countries, like Argentina and Sri Lanka, where that word would always carry weight.
The guy gave her a month, and he wanted everything kept private. His eyes only, no dramatic internet expose.
How could the names be important at that point? Finn said. The conflict ended in 98. The senior people involved were debtor pensioners. Plus, Ireland's the land of word of mouth, between everyone being somebody's cousin to grannies whose surveillance skills put the Mossad to shame. The identities of who was pro-IRA probably weren't all that secret anymore. Would disclosing them really do that much harm?
You know how it goes. It was the first ask. Once you start down that path, it became quite slippery.
McAuliffe rubbed his hand across his chest as though it ached.
No, Fiona had to choose. Lose Eamon, her biological son, or betray her country.
Finn cleared her throat.
Her country? Isn't that a bit extreme? I thought the U.S. didn't give a dog yada yada. And isn't jolly old England a friendly?
McAuliffe regarded her, his expression more serious than severe. Sad, even. You know what going rogue from the agency means? He coursed over Finn's cheeks, reddening them as though she were sitting too close to a fire. She was. So? She said. So, Fiona chose Aemon. Finn couldn't think of what to say, so she kept quiet. It didn't seem to bother McAuliffe, who continued. The data center was locked down, and she couldn't get access, which made it impossible to smuggle in a drive to download the info, or hack into the system to send it off premises. Fiona had to go old school. Every day for 2 weeks, she secretly assessed the read-only file, painstakingly wrote as many names as she could on the inside of her shirt's French cuff, went home, cut off the cuff, hid it in her apartment, and disposed of the ruined shirt. Finn thought about the boutique that sold the white shirts. She'd always paid with cash. The boutique that sold the shirts, McAuliffe said, as though eavesdropping on her thoughts. It doesn't have records from back then, but it's still owned by the same woman. She remembers a 20-something career type buying a half dozen of the same shirts 2 weeks in a row. It was the French cuffs that stuck with her. Something about not owning cufflinks. Finn had a pair, sterling engraved with a T. Her father had left them behind in a bureau drawer when he walked out of her and her sister and mother's lives when Finn was 17. Yeah, she was pretty clever about hiding the intel. Everyone knew sweeps of new ops quarters could happen at any time. She knit a rabbit toy using the shirt cuffs as stuffing. McAuliffe ate some potato chips. The crunching grating like sandpaper on Finn's nerves. She thought of the knitting class at the Belfast Women's Shed. So-called domestic arts had never come easy for Finn. Give her a miter saw and a joiner over needle and thread any day. Her bunny ended up with one ear bigger than the other and mismatched eyes. Fiona's supervisor wasn't oblivious, McAuliffe said. Of course, a senior op was on her. All new agents had won, and though reports were coming back clean, he knew something was off. Fiona's flow of intel was ebbing. He chalked it up to burnout. She hadn't been rotated out with the rest of her class the year before, so he put the wheels in motion to have her recalled for some stateside desk duty before he was dragged for leaving her in the field too long. Well, you can imagine Fiona's reaction when she was told to start packing. Finn could. She always resisted being called in, starting with her first assignment, being out there, no matter where there happened to be, was preferable to being close to anything like home. Living overseas supposedly broadened your horizons. It also was good at helping you forget where you come from. The impending transfer pushed Fiona into a panic, McAuliffe said. Not only did she have to finish procuring the info and deliver it to Colin, she also had to decide what to do next. Go back to the States and lose contact with her boy, or resign from the agency and generate scrutiny that would probably result in deportation, or worse. There was no decision to make, Finn snapped. What choice did she have? Did I touch a nerve? Oh, sorry. This isn't a story with an unknown ending. It's a slide to an inevitable conclusion that started when Fiona wasn't rotated out of Belfast when she should have been. You should tell that to the agency. Oh, they just want to make sure the correct decisions were made, that protocol was followed. Finn's fist banged on the table, rattling silverware against china. They were! At the sound, Sean glanced over. Catching McAuliffe's look, he dropped his head and went back to polishing. Finn lowered her voice to a harsh whisper. I was her
dupe, her duplicate. I know you know that.
A dupe was like a guardian angel. Finn's job had been to keep the new op out of trouble and report on her performance, without the op knowing she was there.
Coincidence or just a cruel joke to assign me an op with the same first name? I don't know, and I don't care. I did everything I was supposed to. I shadowed her. Gym, shopping, pub night, knitting class. I even followed her into the damn ocean. I did my job, and she never made me. And I saw Collins's approach coming from a mile away. We saw him making his move.
But you didn't report it.
It wasn't my place to deprive Fiona of the chance to do the right thing.
She cupped a protective hand around the salt and pepper shakers.
I never guessed how tempting they'd make the bait.
What are the odds? Her DNA.
This is me you're talking to. We both know Eamon wasn't her son. The test was a setup. The result faked. The kid procured. All compliments of the Brits.
McAuliffe nodded but said nothing.
You know, she and I were starting to be friends, although she never knew I was her dupe or even that I worked at the agency.
Finn paused.
She told me about Eamon. Let me meet him.
Did you try to get her to...
What do you think?
Finn shook her head in frustration.
Why would she take another DNA test? What if it came back and showed no relation? Her dream would be destroyed.
Finn abandoned the shakers and sat back in her chair.
The way things played out, she didn't have a choice.
The day of the drop, McAuliffe prompted. Finally, Finn thought, here they were, at the ending McAuliffe was looking for.
The day of the drop, I went to her apartment after she left for her swim. I switched the rabbit I'd made for the one stuffed with shirt cuffs. Fiona left the toy without the names in the pub per Collins' instructions. The boy and his parents, assuming they even were his parents, were gone less than 4 hours later. I checked their apartment, cleaned out.
She folded her arms and glared at McAuliffe.
So, yeah. You can tell the agency protocol was followed. Names everyone probably already knew weren't passed to the Brits. No harm, no foul. That's why I didn't report Fiona.
All I needed to know. McAuliffe reached into his jacket and extracted a photo, which he handed to Finn. It showed a young man in his mid-teens standing beside a roadside bearing an overlong string of consonants and vowels, even 10-plus years on. Finn recognized him.
He's in Wales?
The photo was posted without any info.
He looks like her.
She gave back the photo.
Think he knows what he was part of?
McAuliffe grunted. No idea. He slipped the photo into his pocket. Finn steepled her fingers.
So?
McAuliffe waited. So now it's your turn. What's the rest of the story?
I thought you knew. Fiona slow-walked her transfer, giving her extra weeks in Belfast to search for Eamon and his parents. She finally went back to the States, but the agency let her go after 6 months. Something about unauthorized database access?
She was looking for Eamon.
You don't know that. After she lost her job, she returned to Ireland, traveled through the North and the South, then moved on to England. She never stayed in one place too long. She was looking for Eamon.
Or taking a travel break to ponder career choices. McAuliffe hesitated long enough for Finn's previous apprehension to return in a rush. Second anniversary of the boy's disappearance, she went for a daily swim, got caught in a rip current and was carried out and drowned.
An expert ocean swimmer gets stuck in a rip on that particular day?
Finn scoffed.
It was suicide by water. Cause of death was listed as accidental. It should have read heartbreak. Why wasn't I told?
McAuliffe's gaze was steady. Need to know. You didn't.
Finn gave a dulcetory poke to the pepper shaker. A good agent was lost because of me. Another poke. A good parent, too.
You prevented the transfer of classified info, and Eamon had a mother and a father. Doesn't mean he couldn't use an extra.
As she spoke, Finn's mind flashed back to the ubiquitous and often mocked ads in her college's newspapers. Egg donors wanted $15,000. The exact balance owed for her final semester's tuition, a bill to be paid before she could receive her degree. As if, she'd told the student loan officer at their first meeting.
Her father had left when she was in high school. Her mother was dead, and her sister was out of her life due to circumstances Finn was partially responsible for. How would it feel if a stranger knocked on her door and told Finn she might be their biological mother? Would learning she had a child be as it had been for Fiona? The equivalent of discovering you held the winning ticket for a lottery's grand prize.
Or would it be more like seeing an unexpected shadow on your latest chest x-ray?
Another? She asked McAuliffe with a bright smile, tapping the rim of her glass with a steady finger, hoping she'd never have to find out.
Well, no wonder the author's name is Twist. Boy, till almost the end there, I was just going, yeah. Oh, wait, it's not her. I hope you enjoyed that one. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, they're going to bring us a couple of poems, some poems to close out our show. The first one is by Tom Tolney, and it's called To Sail or Not to Sail on a Frigid Morning. At first light, the blade of cold was so sharp, it slit my throat without drawing blood. From the gunwale I could hear icicles sharpening on the dock, observe sketches of frost splintering the deck. Neath wildly flapping cloth, I stopped breathing in a blast of blow. Sail away in the cutting wind, or warm myself at my cabin on the shore? As the broken edges of sun crept up the sky, the morning's frozen fabric propped up my bones, so I hooked the anchor aloft, untangled the mooring, and shoved out over trembling, impulsive waters. Okay, and to finish off from that same Mallory Queen Mystery Magazine, Carl Robinette brings us our last poem, and it's called The Lost Poem. Smell of blood still in the air, I hung my toe at the edge of the floor-to-ceiling window, flicked my brasher doubloon, and watched it disappear down the stories below. I had a funny feeling, like looking sidelong through a rear view. What's been done can't be undone. But it clung there anyway, an unwashable spot on my memory, an unanswerable question. Did she push him? or just watch him fall. Where is she now? A sleepwalking shadow cast by searchlight dreams. Standing there, I watched Hollywood creep its petty pace across the concrete coil. Players and pushers strutting and fretting under that sign which stood for nothing and never would in a million tomorrows, in smog and bad sunshine like some murky hell. I checked my watch and snapped off my photo, waiting at the edge of this high window. Well, terrific people, that's going to do it for this episode of the Mystery Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Keith Tyler, Tickled Pink, saying thank you so much for joining me, and tune in again next time, would you please? Thank you so much. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.